Good evening and welcome to Health Writers on the Air. I'm your host, Mary Summers. We will begin tonight with health writer Thomas Kozlowski and a report on last year's swine flu vaccine and if it was really needed. Then I will interview Uncle Andy to see why he flip-flops on his political leanings and follow with another new health writer, Andy Ambler, who will be interviewing Lee Suster from socialistworkers.org and the International Socialist Review about the U.S. job crisis. But first, I want to follow up with my thanks to the Obama administration on our last program with their success with the lawsuit that stopped Arizona from enacting SB 1070. Unfortunately, the successful lawsuit was backed up with President Obama signing a new bill authorizing an additional $600 million to increase border security, strengthening a deadly border militarization strategy. The U.S. must increase access to legal immigration, but this will not be enough if the root causes are not addressed. Fair and just trade policies and initiatives will not only help with immigration problems, but the unemployment problems of the U.S. workers who were put out of work by our enactment of unfair trade policies from Clinton and Bush administrations. The Democrats need to tell us what they are going to do if they are elected in January, if they want progressives to help keep them in office. What will they do about fair trade, immigration, adding public option to the health care bill, preserving Social Security, increasing taxes for the wealthy, campaign finance reform, and the Employee Free Choice Act? Many in the media are rightfully giving the Obama administration credit today for using the stimulus bill to turn America greener. But we need to know what Democrats are going to do in January on these and other issues if they want the progressive vote. Now tonight's program.
On January 26, 2010, the Council of Europe launched an investigation whether the World Health Organization, WHO, issued the swine flu pandemic to boost profits for vaccine manufacturers. This has come in response to a growing movement of experts, evidence, and elected officials who spoke against what they see as bad science and fear-mongering aimed at persuading governments to spend billions of dollars on hastily tested vaccines. Dr. Ulrich Kiel, director of WHO's Collaborating Center for Epidemiology, criticized Dr. Keiji Fukuda, WHO's flu chief, for producing campaigns with SARS, avian flu, where always the predictions were wrong. Why don't we learn from history, said Dr. Kiel. The WHO and the CDC ignored the mounting signs that swine flu wasn't much of a killer. Yet world governments had poured tens of billions of dollars into the vaccines. The U.S. spent $2 billion and allowed $7.5 billion in H1N1 preparedness. The allegations by the Council of Europe on H1N1 were called irresponsible, scientifically wrong, and historically incorrect by Dr. Fukuda, the WHO flu director. He denied accusations against the WHO, saying the record clearly states the influenza pandemic policy responses taken were not influenced by the pharmaceutical industry. In June 2009, swine flu took center stage when the WHO declared H1N1 the first pandemic in 42 years. In May, after the swine flu first appeared, the WHO rewrote the definition of pandemic. Under the new meaning, a pandemic does not need to cause high numbers of deaths or illnesses. A month after the change, just 144 people were dead from H1N1. WHO gave it the highest threat classification, a stage 6 pandemic alert, compared to the mildest 20th century pandemic, which killed 1 million people. Dr. Woded said at the Council of Europe meeting, the definition change was designed to boost vaccine sales. There is no other reason. Yet, the WHO stands by its decision, citing geographic spread and the virus's novelty. Dr. Fukuda said his organization will in the future try to define things better. China, Britain, Japan, and other countries urged the WHO to be cautious in declaring swine flu pandemics, fearing a premature announcement could cause widespread panic and confusion. In 2002-2003, the SARS virus killed just 800 and made 8,000 sick. Yet the world spent $80 billion on vaccines. In 2005, the avian flu cost the U.S. government $1 billion and more billions in preparation of the flu outbreaks. The WHO warned it could kill 150 million, but just 250 died worldwide. In 1976, the U.S. had a swine epidemic, which means it kills a high number of people. One person was killed. The hurried vaccine rollout killed 30 and cost the government $500 million in today's dollars. It also caused hundreds of people to contract the crippling Guillain-Barré syndrome. Shouldn't this have made medical communities more skeptical? Doctors may have gone along with the vaccine, as they see it as a single greatest lifesaver in modern medicine, especially with a disease that may become a mass killer. Margaret Scarlatti, after 15 years in the CDC's Center AIDS program, was quoted as saying, quote, "the political ideology is being substituted for science," unquote. The CDC Foundation raises money from private donors. All U.S. contracts for H1N1 vaccines were to five companies, CSL Limited, Norvitus, Sanofi Pasteur, GlaxoSmithKline, and MediImmune. They also produced shots for SARS and avian flu. British MP Paul Flynn says these drug makers invest $4 billion in preparations for swine flu before any contracts were issued. Dr. Woodard said these funds may have gone into developing and patenting the new super methods to produce vaccines. With patented drugs, companies can charge more and have a monopoly. Quote, "it's the economic dimension of the problem which we have to have in mind as we consider how this all happened," unquote. The food and drug agencies in Canada, UK, France, US, and elsewhere guaranteed vaccine manufacturers they would be shielded from any lawsuits connected to any vaccine problems. Some drug trials were as short as 5 days. Dr. Warded voiced concern that hastily developed vaccines may not be entirely safe. Some vaccines that produce an autoimmunity sold in Europe and Canada are banned in the U.S. It is estimated the global H1N1 vaccine will be worth over $7 billion by 2011. Could some of these expected profits be used to buy influence? Dr. Marcia Angel, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine and senior lecturer at Harvard Medical School, believes that is what happened. Not just with the swine flu, but drug-based medicine in general. She said over the past 2 decades, the drug industry has moved from the purpose of discovering and producing useful new drugs to selling drugs of dubious benefits, using its wealth and power to co-opt every institution that may stand in its way, including the U.S. Congress, the FDA, medical centers, and even the medical profession. A master study in the Lancet December issue reported no evidence that flu vaccines prevent death in children under 2, advising against it. An unreleased Canadian study of around 12 million Canadians who received last year's vaccine may be twice as likely to get it this year. Scientists have no idea how seasonal flu and H1N1 vaccines are connected. H1N1 is composed of flu strains found in bird, human, and pig viruses from both the U.S. and Europe. One theory is the international pig trade enabled the crossing of strains. According to a November 24th article in the Virology Journal, but still remains a mystery. The new strain of swine flu in April, first found in Mexico, is believed to have been spawned at hog farms in the U.S., reported the journal. And now an update regarding the swine flu. The World Health Organization acknowledged Tuesday, August 11, 2010, that the swine flu pandemic is finally over, long after many national authorities started canceling vaccine orders. For Health Writers, this is Thomas Kozlowski.
Thank you, Thomas. And now I'll interview Uncle Andy and then Andy Ambler. Uncle Andy, after listening to you the last few weeks, I have some questions to ask you. First, you are a liberal, then a conservative, back to a liberal progressive. Why all this flip-flopping?
I don't know why you call it flip-flopping. I call it thinking. And I started off as a passive liberal, and I decided to be lazy and become a conservative. But all of a sudden, Leah Zeldin and all these singers came to see me in the middle of the night. Pete Seeger, Johnny Cash. And they all made me feel guilty. And then Leah, of course, threatened me. If I didn't come around, she was going to have lock me in a room and have Tiny Tim singing Tiptoe Through the Tulips all night. So I immediately learned it's about time I became an active liberal.
So what are you? Now, an active liberal? How is that working?
Well, an active liberal is one that doesn't think that everybody's going to do things for them. You know, we have some liberals who sit around and agree on things, but they're waiting for somebody else to do it. I look at certain heroes, you know. One of them was, and he wasn't a really nice man, but he was dynamic. It was Huey Long. I loved Huey Long, you know. His theme was every man a king. He wanted to tax corporations. Can you believe it? Today they call him a socialist. But Huey Long was one of those great guys. The other one was Mother Jones, a dear old Irish girl. She was born in Cork. And, you know, I don't know if you ever heard that song, She's Coming Around the Mountain, but that song was written about Mother Jones going to visit coal mines. Those are the kind of people I want to be like. I mean, why not? They're not unique in the sense that only they can do those things. We can do them too, and that's what I want to do.
Well, this sounds pretty good. But why are you with Health Writers? What in the world do you know about health issues?
Well, you know, I think that's kind of a blot on my record because, first of all, I believe in health and I champion it. Anytime I hear the word health, I get up and salute. I have videos about healthy people that I watch. I believe in food. The more food, the better. And I try to get good food. Not always, but sometimes I get good food. So I don't know why people say that I'm not healthy. You know, I'm a little more healthy than most people.
Well, you do look a little over healthy, Uncle Andy. And I am worried that you don't follow good health practices like eating well. And also, what about regular exercise?
Oh, I believe in regular exercise, too, and I have videos of people doing that. But, you know, my family had a motto. If something's worth doing, it's worth doing to excess. And I believe health is one of those things we should do to excess. I believe, like you, I should go around and make other people feel guilty about the fact that they didn't exercise and they're not eating right. But other than that, I'm doing okay.
I'm not really convinced that you have good health practices, but you seem to understand the health of the body politic. But where are your convictions?
I had two, one for disorderly conduct and the other was a battery. But other than that, I don't have too many other convictions, but how many do you want?
Well, Uncle Andy, I guess that's enough. Two's enough. And we do love you, so just keep working. And what are you going to have for us in 2 weeks?
Well, I was going to think, you know, I've been working on religions. I've been trying to think about what I should be, what kind of religion and so on. I'm watching this scandal going on now in New York on mosques, and I kind of call it Profiles in Cowardice. But I would like to look at some of the religions and how they affect us. And I think I'll try and talk a little bit about that.
Well, thank you, Uncle Andy. See you then.
I want to live. I want to give. I've been a miner for a heart of gold. It's these expressions I never give that keep me searching for a heart of gold. And I'm getting old. Keeps me searching for a heart of gold. And I'm getting old. I've been to Hollywood, I've been to Redwoods. I crossed the ocean for a heart of gold. I've been in my mind, it's such a fine line that keeps me searching for a heart of gold. And I'm getting old.
It's a state of emergency. 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 It's a state of emergency.
Slowly, but surely, we are moving in the right direction. We're on the right track. The economy is getting stronger, but it really suffered a big trauma. And we're not going to get all 8 million jobs that were lost back overnight. It's going to take some time.
That was Detroit rapper and activist Invincible with a track called State of Emergency, followed by a clip of President Obama on August 18th with an optimistic outlook for the direction our economy is headed. But a closer look at the actual unemployment trends paints a much bleaker picture. 2 days after Obama's speech to Ohio families on the economy, the U.S. Department of Labor released figures that show new applicants for unemployment benefits unexpectedly rose to 500,000 the previous week, the highest level since December 2009. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, the official unemployment number for the month of July was 9.5%. But that number was misleading when you look at how the figures are calculated by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. This official unemployment measurement is categorized as U3, which refers to the proportion of the civilian labor force that is unemployed but actively seeking unemployment. A further look at the statistics shows a category called U6. The U6 category takes the official unemployment rate and adds in people categorized as discouraged workers who have stopped looking for work because current economic conditions make them believe that no work is available for them. Additionally, the number includes marginally attached workers who are able to work but have not looked for work recently. And the U6 also lumps in part-time workers who want to work full-time but cannot due to economic reasons. When you factor in all those people seeking work, the unemployment number looks more like 16.5%. There is a growing number of unemployed people being referred to as 99ers. They are the 1.4 million people that have used up all their unemployment benefits and are lucky to be receiving food stamps. Economists fear that the August report will be worse. This will partially be due to the remainder of the 2010 U.S. Census workers being let go and forced to once again desperately seek work. The Obama administration, however, paints a prettier picture about our long-term economic recovery. The administration estimates that the official unemployment rate will drop to 8.7% by the end of 2011 and then sink to 6.8% by the end of 2013. With a lack of expediency by the administration to create jobs, this hardly seems possible. The Obama administration needs to stop increasing the funding for the wars of aggression in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and Yemen when there are states across the country facing record budget crises. We should be hiring teachers and developing public works projects to get people back to work, not slashing public spending and firing hundreds of teachers on a whim. The financial reform should have held Wall Street accountable for their risky gambling and carelessness. Instead, the administration pours money into the banks, which in turn lines the pockets of the CEOs that got us into this mess. What do we need to do, you might ask? We need to mobilize en masse and demand that our government funds jobs and not wars. Demand that Washington bails out Main Street and not Wall Street. We need to hold the Democrats and the Republicans accountable for their mishandling of our budget, which sets aside $738 billion in defense spending for the year of 2011. And you can do that by going to Washington, D.C. on October 2nd to march for jobs, peace, and justice. Check out www.onenationforpeace.org and get your union to mobilize people as one nation working together. And now let's welcome Lee Sustar, where we talk about the jobs crisis.
This is Lee Sustar. I write for socialistworker.org on a range of economic and political issues. I'm also a labor activist here in Chicago, a member of the National Writers Union. I contribute to the International Socialist Review.
With the midterms upcoming and the economy number one in America's eyes and the stimulus not putting out as many jobs as they predicted, there's fears of a second or double dip recession. Why haven't we seen any improvement?
The shorter answer is that the stimulus program enacted by the Obama administration early 2009, while huge at $787 billion, was quite a bit smaller than it needed to actually have the kind of punch required to really shift the economy into a higher gear. Christina Romer, who is the outgoing head of Obama's economic advisors team, said at the time that she didn't think it was big enough. Paul Krugman, the economist and New York Times columnist, has also said he thought it should be at least twice as big. And as a result, the stimulus package, whose impact was blunted, in fact, by devoting about a third of it to tax cuts, which is a less effective way of boosting the economy, hasn't really been able to overcome from the tremendous downward pressures on the U.S. economy. And that's where you get to the longer part of the problem. The U.S. economy, like the world economy, is suffering from not just the impact of the financial crisis, which broke, as we all know, dramatically in the fall of 2008 with a near meltdown of the financial system. That financial crash was a reflection of a longer-term problem in the world economy, which is basically a crisis of overproduction. By that I mean not just too many products to be sold at a profit, but too many factories, too many offices, too much infrastructure required to produce them, which has created a downward pressure on profits in some of the leading economies of the world. And that problem of overcapacity has not gone away. In fact, the stimulus that was pursued worldwide in the beginning of 2009 only postponed the problem and transferred it from a problem of private companies to a problem of government. So you have, for example, a small state like Ireland or Greece stepping in to bail out its financial system. That in turn has created a big fiscal crisis. Therefore, you have a turn towards austerity. Cut back social spending, cuts in public sector workers' pay and benefits, and that's proceeded dramatically. In fact, that trend is pretty much worldwide, of course, coming to the U.S. Quite forcefully as well, as the stimulus money is finally running out and state and local budget cuts are getting deeper and deeper. So having bailed out the world financial system, the governments of the world now find the red ink on their books, and they're trying to recover from that on the back of working people.
All right, thank you. There is a recent article that Time posted, How the Stimulus is Changing America, and it indicates that the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, President Obama's $787 billion stimulus, has been marketed as a jobs bill, and that's how it's been judged. The White House says it's saved or created about 3 million jobs, helping avoid a depression and end a recession. Do you agree or disagree with this statement?
Well, may be true. I mean, certainly the stimulus did prevent the entire economy from unraveling. It was, in a sense, to borrow a term from the oil disaster, a blowout preventer. But the leak has continued in the sense that the economy has not been able to recover the kind of strength that's needed to overcome the high rates of joblessness. the U.S. economy were growing at a speed that could create jobs in a normal economic recovery in the post-war era, we'd be looking about 300,000 or 400,000 jobs created each month. In fact, we're barely in positive territory, and the rate of job creation is insufficient to compensate for the number of people who are entering the workforce each year as young people graduate from high school and college and enter the workforce. So while the economy has gotten a kind of a basic boost from the stimulus package, keeping it from completely unraveling, it hasn't actually been able to push through the kind of growth that's needed.
And my final question for you would be, what do you say would be the solution to this jobs crisis?
Working people find themselves, if they're lucky to have enough to have a job, find themselves feeling vulnerable at the possibility of losing it, and also find themselves having to take either furlough days, wage cuts, or both, and find themselves unable to keep their head above water. So the pressure is going to continue for some time unless and until working people get organized and begin to pressure capital for concessions. There is a march, an important march, on October 2nd in Washington, D.C., a march for jobs with justice, and that's an important demand. It's an important rallying cry, and it'll be important for everyone to support that who possibly can. But we should also keep in mind that it's being used in large part to mobilize the electoral base for the Democratic Party. And if there's going to be any meaningful campaign for jobs, it's going to have to go well beyond October 2nd. What we need is to go to Washington on that day, make those demands, and then go back into our cities and towns and communities across the country and begin finding ways to organize to put those demands into action locally, whether it's fighting local budget cuts, supporting workers in a organizing campaign or a strike, fighting tuition increases at colleges. The struggles will take many different forms, but the important thing is to understand that the long-term picture for the economy is one of continued high rates of employment, as well as increasing pressure on wages and benefits. That's not going to change unless and until people organize to fight for that change.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today, Lee. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to speak with me today.
Thank you for having me.
For Health Writers.
And now some healthy bits and pieces. On Saturday, dogs can join their humans in taking the plunge during the first doggy dip at Baraboo's outdoor swimming pool from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. at the pool in Campbell Park. And it was chicken feed with salmonella bacteria that could have caused the outbreak at two Iowa producers that sparked a recall of more than a half billion contaminated eggs last week. U.S. regulators said today samples that tested positive for salmonella were collected from barns at the two farms and from feed ingredients given to pullets at both farms. That does it for this week's program. Remember, this Sunday is the second Black and Latino Unity Picnic at Penn Park from 1 to 6 p.m. Thank you for joining us, and special thanks to health writers Tom Kozlowski, Andy Summers, Andy Ambler, and our guests Lee Sustar and our engineer Bill Scallon. Please visit our website at healthwriters.wordpress.com. Good night, Mary Summers.